important that we not only speak about him, but that we visualize him as well.
And therefore, this is a culture that's going up in hopefully many schools and shuls throughout. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is my teacher for many, many years. He's the one that has shaped my life, and we'll go through a little bit later exactly the role that he's played. And I would suggest that this synagogue as well should have at some point, someplace, a picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. Tonight we're not going to speak about his teachings, his brilliance, his personality, his psychology, or even his life story, though all of these at one point or other will come into play in our discussion. What we are going to do here this evening is to share my personal reflections, and therefore you have two questions that you want to ask me. The first question you have to ask me is, why should you care about Rabbi Soloveitchik? He's obviously not of our Syrian community, and you might argue, well, but it has nothing to do with us. Welcome, good to see you. Welcome. There's no reason in the world, you may argue, that I should know about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And in fact, many of the Syrian rabbis wouldn't tell you that. There's no reason you should or want to know anything about Rabbi Soloveitchik. In fact, when I first got into Rabbi Soloveitchik's shiur, which I'll describe a little bit as we go along, Chaim Baruch had met me on King's Highway, I remember very well, it was back 25 or 30 years, and I said, I was very proud, it was a wonderful accomplishment, and I said to him, "Ani achshav shiur shel Rabbi Soloveitchik," and he answered to me, "Yesh lo devarim muzarim." He's very strange in some things that he says. So at that point, obviously Chaim Baruch was not enamored with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and therefore many Syrian rabbis will say that it's not a place for a good Syrian boy to be. So the question that any Syrian congregation we're in, we are talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik, should raise the question, why in fact do we have to know about Rabbi Soloveitchik, is the first question. And second of all, you might raise the question, why should we care about you, Rabbi Labaton's personal reflections? Who cares what you think or feel about Rabbi Soloveitchik? The second question is less important than the first question, because on some level, everyone here, in some sense, is a seriously committed Jew. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a seriously committed religious Jew, or better, one should say, I would say, though he, of course, would not agree with the statement, that he was the ideal Jew from my point of view. I would say that he was the ideal Jew, period, without any qualifiers, although, of course, he would, without question, frown at such what I'm going to call an absurd statement. And I'll admit to you that it is an absurd statement that makes very little sense to many people. However, for some strange reason, I'm going to stand by that statement and going to defend it in the course of our discussion. And I would go further to say that a Jew of this type comes along once every 1,000 years. Also, perhaps an absurd statement, but still nevertheless, I think, true. Now, you should want to come to know a Jew of this type. What does he offer? What does he communicate? What does he represent? Why should one want to know a person of this type? Come back to that. Now, why should you care about my personal reflections? The answer is, you shouldn't. There is no reason that you should care about what I have to say. In fact, I would go so far as to say that what I have to say is trite unimportant. But perhaps they will be able to convey to you something about the Rav. Rabbi Soloveitchik was known as the Rav, affectionately and with a great deal of respect, as the Rav. And perhaps my reflections will convey to you something that his official biography would not convey to you. Something perhaps, we'll call it, of a human dimension that goes beyond the truth of the quote-unquote official biography. I may go even further than this and say that sometimes personal reflections will communicate a dimension that the official biography cannot actually communicate whatsoever. But I'm not concerned with it, but I will give you access to it, as you'll see as we go along. What I want to achieve this evening is for you to come to know the person, the man, not the historical background that actually produced the person, the man. In fact, from my point of view, it's not only that I want you to come to know who Rabbi Soloveitchik is, I would say to you that in many ways I am desperate that you know the man. To me, this is not simply a class to give, but it's something almost, I'm saying, an obligation that I have that I have to communicate the information as to who and what Rabbi Soloveitchik was all about. I would say to you that the knowledge of him is a gift that I would like to share with you this evening, an important gift. And in a word, I would say to you that simply knowing and studying with Rabbi Soloveitchik has immeasurably enriched my life, intellectually, emotionally, existentially, experientially, in every which way that you could imagine. It was an overwhelming experience. And I'd like to share that wealth with you, or whatever measure I can. We should all try to engage in those things in life that enrich. The Rabbi Soloveitchik enriches. Certainly we all have to make the choice that we could spend our lives in watching football games and drinking beer. And we may even think that that enriches our life, and to some degree or other, to some people, that does in fact enrich life. Not going to argue that point. However, there are many other things that enrich life, many other experiences that enrich life, and I would like to, in some measure or other, share with you how Rabbi Soloveitchik enriched my life. It is true that it's very difficult to in fact do that. It's very difficult to share with you an experience that you have not experienced. How can words alone capture that experience that I experienced? And as we go along, you'll see how profound of an impression Rabbi Soloveitchik had made upon me. In the same way, if I were to try to share with you the experience of marriage, how extraordinarily enriching it is, or share with you the experience of having children, how extraordinary experience that is, if you haven't yet had children, then of course you're not going to really capture it. I could be the most eloquent speaker in the whole entire world and still not be able to capture neither the experience of love, of marriage, in the verbalization of it, nor the experience of having children. Yet nevertheless, certainly it's worthwhile to try to capture that experience and try to engage you and share with you the gift, the wealth, the person of Rabbi Soloveitchik who has enriched my life, almost one would say by accident. I did not try to experience Rabbi Soloveitchik in any which way, and many, I guess one might say, do not feel the way. You're going to hear Rabbi Harari next week, and I'm not sure whether or not he will share the same experience that I'm sharing with you. I don't know if he was as impacted by the Rav as I was. That you'll see as we go along. But I do believe that any person who has had such exposure to the Rav does and feel to one degree or another enriched by the experience. And those of you going to come next week should ask Rabbi Harari the question whether or not you feel enriched by the experience of having studied with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I would like to communicate to you this evening through these personal reflections and the narrative that I had. Not the truth of the man. It would certainly be what I'm going to call chutzpah, overly bold. In no way do I think that I'm able to capture the truth or even the uniqueness of the man. And that certainly, for many, it would be the obligation of a speaker to in fact capture the essence of who Rabbi Soloveitchik is and what he was all about. That would be overly bold and chutzpah. One cannot do so. But certainly, what I do have the right to do is to communicate to you the feeling that I have, and perhaps that feeling may be more legitimate in some ways than the truth of the man itself. Now, allow me to go back to my original absurd statement, which was, those of you who didn't come late, know, which is that Rabbi Soloveitchik represents the ideal Jew who comes along every 1,000 years. Now, again, that is something that should be challenged. How dare you say that? My ideal. But I'm going to say further than that, he is the ideal Jew. So let's see how we defend that statement. How are we going to defend it? Now, obviously, the year number 1,000 was not necessarily a random number. It's close to 850 years. Why have I chosen that number? Why have I said Rabbi Soloveitchik is the ideal Jew who comes along once every 850 years? Good, good. So that number is not accidental, but rather I'm comparing Rabbi Soloveitchik to the Rambam. And those, of course, who know Rabbi Soloveitchik know that the Rav and the Rambam shared much in common. What did they share in common? Obviously, both were fiercely loyal to Torah and to the Jewish tradition. Fiercely loyal. There are some axioms in life that we have to accept as human beings. We cannot challenge all areas or aspects of life, but we accept certain axioms. Both the Rambam and the Soloveitchik were born into rabbinic families that accepted from the time they were infants the Weltanschauung or the world outlook of a rabbinic religious Jew. But both were intensely serious about halakha, Jewish law, as well as living life traditionally, based on, of course, Jewish sources. Both were, however, to one measure or another, in one case or another, willing to challenge those sources, but always only up to a certain point. We'll get to that later on. Both were concerned about the direction of halakha, as well as the philosophy of halakha. One, of course, should read, if one is and wants to be a literate Jew, level 3, this is not level 1, level 3, both Rabbi Soloveitchik's Isha Halacha, which is an extraordinarily profound and yet difficult but very important work, as well as Morei Nevuchim, part 3, 51-54, to get a sense of the Rambam's philosophy of Halacha. One wants to know, a shortcut, rather than reading part 3, 51-54, which is only about 10 or 12 pages, you can read Rabbi Trotsky's book, which is 592 pages. That's a shortcut. Right, that's Rabbi Trotsky. You read the first, and if you want a shortcut, you read Rabbi Trotsky's part, chapter 1 and chapter 6, which is only about half the book. But if you read those two, you get a good sense as to what the Rambam was really all about.
He was a son-in-law, right?
Yes. Rabbi Trotsky was Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law. Correct. That's correct. The Rav was certainly described by many, and it's not far off the mind, far off the mark, as an existentialist. The Rambam was described as a Neoplatonic Aristotelian. Not important for us what those terms really mean, but it does point to one fact that both were interested in philosophy. Both were concerned with the current philosophical notions swirling around the Jewish world at that period of time. Now, is that true of every single great rabbinic sage? Answer?
No.
Of course not. Of course not. Let's take any other rabbinic sage of the modern period. Let's take Chacham Avodei Yosef. Kiyodom Kumono Munach. Fantastic Talmid Chacham. Is he concerned in any which measure whatever about the current philosophical issues that engage philosophical minds? The answer is, of course not. Has no clue, not interested, has no meaning to him, completely way beyond him, one would say. Similarly, one can obviously find great sages of the medieval period of time, contemporaries of the Rambam, who are not interested either in the philosophical norms, the philosophical issues that engage the mind of the Rambam. Whether he's going to speak about Rashi, Ba'arayat Tosafot, any of these, as opposed to, on the other hand, Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya, Sa'aj Gaon, all who preceded the Rambam, were concerned about the philosophical issues. One of the ways that we can define what we're going to speak about in 2 weeks on May 17th, modern orthodoxy, is the engagement in the modern world. Obviously, modern is a relative term. The modern world in the 12th century was the modern world for them, as is the modern world nowadays, the modern world for us. Both the Rambam and the Rav were both concerned about modern world issues. The Rambam as a Neoplatonic Aristotelian, the Rav as an existentialist, in quotes, to whatever measure he was, certainly both engaged the philosophical issues of that period of time, although not really as philosophers. Many will argue that Morei Nevuchim is not a philosophical book. Philosophical book begins with a statement of its premises. Morei Nevuchim does not begin with a statement of its premises. It's a book wherein Morei Nevuchim there is confusion between the engagement of he who has studied rabbinic sources, he's a religious Jew, knows rabbinic sources, and modern philosophical norms, and there's a clash of those two sets of norms. The person is confused. He needs a guide to the perplexed. And so too, one does not see Ish HaLacha as a philosophical work that a Kantian person would write. No, it's about halachic man. It's a philosophical work, as is the halachic mind. A philosophical work, but it's not really pure philosophy. It's really a result of the clash between two norms. The philosophical secular norms and the religious norms that we live by. And how do we live that way? Both of these great thinkers are willing to engage these philosophical norms of the modern period of time, and they are willing to write a philosophical or quasi-philosophical work that expresses how we Jews see the world despite or through the lens of this new modern philosophical norms. Obviously, anybody that's gone to college and taken any philosophical course is going to be challenged by these issues if you have any sort of integrationist kind of a mind. Meaning, you're going to read Kantian philosophy, and you're going to raise the question, one second, was Abraham, our forefather, moral, in quotes, by virtue of Kantian moral ethics? Or not? Does he fail the test? Wants to raise that as a question. Or killing Amalek, destroying every single man who tried to Amalek, does that make the Kantian moral grade? Is an interesting question. Similarly, yeah, Harvey?
I'm going to sound stupid, maybe I missed something, but Kantian is the part
of Immanuel Kant, probably the greatest philosopher of the modern period of time, 18th century. He was a friend of Moses Mendelssohn. They discussed philosophy together, which is interesting. A German. He's a standard, and he is the Einstein, because you know that reference term, of moral philosophy. Very few people would disagree with that statement.
Strictly
secular. Not Jewish.
Okay, no,
good old boy.
Thank you.
Fantastic mind, brilliant mind. At one point in life, should read a little bit of Kantian philosophy. His moral structure, how he deals with the moral universe. But yet, you're going to raise that question. Yeah.
Same question.
You're only too smart to ask the question, so I'm very impressed. Please ask the question. Very good. Bold enough. Heroic enough. Those important terms are always celebration, so we'll get back to them. Similarly, Hegel of the 19th century was an extraordinary, overarching mind. He wrote the last great philosophy of history. So one has to raise the question, by Hegel's criteria of as a philosopher of history, he writes about the Jews, appreciative of what the Jews have contributed to the history of mankind, and yet we were left behind. We were a great stage in the development or developing manifestation or revelation of the divine. We were the first great stage, perhaps one might say. Paganism, push aside. But then you have Catholicism, and you have Protestantism, and that really is the final culmination of human history. So it's a fantastic work, how he's able to integrate all the details of history into this overarching philosophical framework. So you have to raise the question, how do we match up as Jews engaging this extraordinary mind? You want to know the answer to that question. Similarly, if you were to read, let's say, the great atheists of the 20th century, there are two. To whom am I referring?
Russell.
Sorry?
Russell's
one.
Freud.
Last century. Sartre. Right? Sartre and Russell. Now you want to know, well, these are great philosophical minds, Richard Russell is certainly outstanding, and you want to know, how do we match up to what Russell says about the existence or lack thereof of God? We are proponents of a God-centered life, obviously. So if we are, Russell comes along and laughs at us. Well, how are we going to respond to his laughter? So to Sartre. So now, therefore, anybody that's gone to college, anybody that's taken any of these courses, is going to worry about engaging these best and brightest in the same way that as Jews we want to engage in what Einstein says about the physical universe. Because if Einstein came along, or any of the other, let's say, scientific minds, and denied our worldview, the part of our worldview that deals with science, then are we going to change our worldview? Are we going to say that he's right, we're wrong, he's right? How are we going to engage those great minds? So the same way that we did it last semester scientifically, one should do it philosophically as well. How do we match up to the great philosophical minds of the modern period? Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, as well as, of course, the Rambam, both engaged the outside world, whether Neoplatonic, Aristotelianly, as the Rambam, as essentially both engaged. But not, again, as pure philosophers, but rather as Jewish thinkers. Both men were of great integrity and honesty, both profoundly human, both people of great compassion. The Rambam has an interesting statement that one should look up in Halachot Amatul Ayyadunim, his Laws of Charity. That is chapter 7, Perek Zayin. And he says, Mishu Achzari, he was cruel, ve'eno merachem, and has no compassion, obviously, on the poor. Yesh lahush liyochsav. You have to suspect his genealogy. Can't be Jewish if he's a cruel, compassionless person. Can't be Jewish. It's a drama. It's a striking statement. Why? Because he's almost placing compassion in a biological, genetic framework as opposed to a psychological category. Almost. But, or maybe not even almost. He's really saying, if you are somebody who is cruel and have no compassion for the poor, then suspect your biology. How can you be a cruel Jew? He, the Rambam would say, it's an oxymoronic statement. So the Rambam strongly is a person of deep compassion, care, concern, those people who don't have. Even to the extent when in Chol Melachim, chapter 10 or 11, talks about the relationship that we have to even that Akum, that pagan. They didn't talk about a pagan. It's not clear because you have to look at the uncensored edition of the Rambam, where it talks about that non-Jewish person who lives in Israel, who's, if they call, let's call him a Ger Toshav, then he wouldn't be a pagan if he's a Ger Toshav, but certainly not Jewish. And you have the obligation of burying his dead, of visiting him when he's ill, Bikur Cholim, all to the non-Jewish person. Why? And he quotes the Pasuk, because the Torah's ways are ways of peace and harmony. Mishleh teaches us that. So the Rambam ends and sees the entire revolving acts of Judaism around issues of compassion, issues of concern for the other person. Even those who would think that because he ends his Mishneh Torah on the Pasuk, Uma'at De'at Hashem, would say, no, the Rambam's that great intellectual. He only cares about philosophy. How can I prove you wrong by simply quoting to you? Moreh Nebuchim. Very good. Because what it tells you at the end of Moreh Nebuchim? The end of Moreh Nebuchim, which is the height of intellectualism, and you finally reach the palace of God Himself. And now what happens? Rambam will tell you. He will quote for you the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu Perek Tet Pasuk Kaf Bet, 9:22. And you should be aware of this Pasuk, I'm sure I quoted it before. You should know by heart. A wise person, don't self-glorify in your wisdom. And don't glorify in your great wealth. And don't self-glorify in your strength, your stature, neither in wisdom, nor in wealth, nor in strength or stature to glorify. But rather in this should glorify. Come to know me. So that's Yirmiyahu Perek Pasuk Kaf Gimel. So you're saying, oh, you see, it's intellectualism, Ivy Tower scholarship. Kenya Hashem, Yirmiyahu says, what's the end? Hashem, Oseh Chesed Kamishpat Baat, Yerav Hasnivu Hashem. Because what do I really want from you? Kenya Hashem, Oseh Chesed Mishpat Sakah Baat. I want righteousness, I want compassion, I want kindness. This is what I really want, God says. So now what's the Rambam telling you then, Moreh Nebuchim? Come to know me and translate your compassion, translate your knowledge of God into compassion for your fellow human being. Which of course is the teaching of Tzelem Elokim. Because you are created in Elokim, I have to have compassion for you. So now, it's an interesting issue. Today we had a blood drive in Hillel. What's my question now? I want you all to go give blood. Why are you giving blood? Because God said so, or because it's a humanitarian gesture?
Free pocket.
Free parking, right. Boston.
They're one and the same.
They're not one and the same. Okay, good. So therefore, the answer to my question might be that give blood because the mitzvah, right, which is knowledge of God, which has to, of necessity, translate into having compassion. In other words, one should not be, from the Rambam's point of view, a bleeding heart, knee-jerk liberal, loving of all humanity, but rather love humanity because God said so. See the human being as a reflection of God's presence, sentimental king. Not because you're naturally kind and humanitarianly oriented, but rather because the Ahat Hashem, knowledge of God, leads you to a love of mankind. So the Rambam sees these two as A leading to B. So the Rambam certainly was that person who was very concerned about these kinds of issues. Wait, when Ibrahim tells, yeah.
Why is the difference on point between those two?
Because what if God does not command me to do something, or rather, what if God commands me to do that which is my bleeding heart, right, does not see as compassionate, but just keep killing all of Amalek? So it's one issue that one has to expand upon, not for now. That's only one issue. But certainly, when we look at Moreh Nebuchadnezzar, the end of it, we do get a sense of to what degree the Rambam was concerned about human beings. So, and throughout all of Mishneh Torah, another example, you look in Hachot Purim. Hachot Purim, very last chapter, here's Hachot Purim. Rambam lists, of course, the four mitzvot you have on Purim. Read the Megillah twice. Have a Seudah mitzvah. Now, you could raise the question, and to the best of my knowledge, Rambam is the first to raise this question. Which of these four is most important? Right. So the Rambam, and you should look this up as well, in an extended statement, in an incredible statement, will say that giving to the poor is the most, over here, because it's much more important to make the poor person who has nothing to eat happy and joyous, more important than eating your own seudat mitzvah. So the poor, again, takes center stage for the Rambam over here. To an extraordinary degree, where the pasuk that he quotes in that particular statement is what? You are like God when you do this. When you are concerned about the poor person, you are imitating God. That's what God wants of you, to do that particular act. Concern for the poor, give to him. Share with him, rather than simply having a fantastic seudat mitzvah. Which translates practically into, let's say you have seudat mitzvah and you invite 15 people over. So it costs you $150. Right? $100? What about? It's more than that? Is that what you spent? More than that? Oh no. So, let's say it costs you $200. Right? You have a nice roast dinner and you have chicken and you have hamid lahmajin. What should you do? What should we do? Cut it in half and give half to charity. Well, we had Mordechai's bar mitzvah a few weeks ago. That was the issue. Ellen told the caterer, I want not to spend a lot on having a fancy dinner. We want your cheapest dinner. This is a wonderful woman, this lady, this woman over here. I want to have the cheapest dinner. I didn't have any restrictions. Whatever. So whatever it is. That's what it is. The cheapest dinner you could have. And then whatever money we saved, she had bought, well, that is what I said, she had bought, instead of buying flowers for the centerpieces, she bought 20 or 30 things that High Lifeline need for their camp.
Oh, wow.
Cancer kids. And she called, asked, what do they need? So one needed school supplies, one needed balls, all kinds of basketballs and balls. She went out and bought 20, 25 of those things, and she said, and Mordechai learned a lesson. That we're not concerned about the flowers that are going to be thrown away, we're going to learn about giving to these kids. Mm-hmm. So that's the hesed that she had taught Mordechai in terms of that issue. So that's the way one should do. Instead of having a fantastic affair, have less of a fantastic affair, because who cares what you eat anyway, really? And then the rest of the money should be given to charity. Right? That's what we should teach our children. So obviously that's the Rambam's practical implication. Rambam is telling you, instead of having this fantastic seudat mitzvah, and spend $200, spend $100, and have chopped liver, and give the rest to charity. So that's the Rambam. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik also, in Isha Aracha, has the very same strong humanitarian streak in him as well. Who is Isha Aracha, the man of Halacha? What is he really all about? Right? So the Rambam, the Rav talks about this in Isha Halacha, page 91. Isha Halacha takes up his stand in the midst of the concrete world. He's very much a this worldly person. His feet planted firmly on the ground of reality, and he looks about and sees, listens, and hears, and publicly protests against the oppression of the helpless, the defrauding of the poor, the plight of the orphan. What is the thrust of all of Judaism? This is it. This is what it's really all about. And of course, anybody that knows the Nevi'im, Amos, etc., knows this is what it's all about. He is the father of the orphans. Right? This is the thrust of what Judaism is all about. He's Avi Yetomim, Dayan Almanot, the judge of the widows. My uncle, Rav Meir Berlin Bar Ilan, told me that once Rav Chaim of Brisk, Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, was asked what the function of a rabbi is. That is, to me, a frightening statement. It's a powerful statement. And how does one live as a rabbi given the following statement? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is a rabbi. So it's his grandfather who innovated a new Talmudic method of how to study Talmud. For the first time in 1,000 years, we have a new way of studying Talmud called the Brisk method, which is based on strict definition, classification, conceptualization. That's what it is. You have this whole Talmud, and you have all kinds of issues that are dealt with in the Talmud. So Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim, would take a sugya, a portion, and he would define the categories very carefully and very clearly, define, analyze, conceptualize, and classify. And he would argue that's the Rambam did. What it did or not is an interesting question. We know that's the Rambam did. To classify, conceptualize what it's really all about. And thereby understand halakha much more so. Example given, though it's not part of our topic. A brisk analysis, let's say of avelut, of mourning, would be the following. As an avel, we are required to tear our clothes. Right? Tearing the clothes is, of course, what we're going to call ma'aseh ha-mitzvah. You have to do the deed, ma'aseh ha-mitzvah, of tearing your clothes as an avel. That's clearly it. However, the brisk would say, you did not fulfill the mitzvah itself by simply tearing your clothes. You just did the ma'aseh mitzvah. Rather, there's another part of the mitzvah, which is what? The kiyuma mitzvah. What's the kiyuma mitzvah? Feeling agony over a person lost. Feeling an emotional sense of emptiness, the void in life. So of course your question would be, what if you do the tearing, and you're happy the guy died? Who cares about the guy anyway? He didn't buy me a car when I was 21. Kish, who needs him? Right?
You shouldn't tear.
Then perhaps one shouldn't tear, but certainly in the field of mitzvah. Similarly, praying. The ma'aseh mitzvah of praying is the verbalization of the tefillah, the words. What's the kiyuma mitzvah? Tefillah mitzvah is not the praying itself per se, rather it's the awareness of standing in front of God. Let's say one prays, he does ma'aseh mitzvah. He went through the entire mitzvah. It's great. However, did not fulfill the mitzvah if he does not have that awareness, that sense of standing in front of Borei Olam when you're praying. In multiple areas, Rav Soloveitchik would create another halakha category because the details of halakha have not fit well. So therefore, he has to create what's known as tudinim, as a halakha. And this is a halakha in that, to satisfy the needs of clear definitions and conceptualizations. So that's Rav Chaim. And everybody, of course, would say he's a super intellectual, profoundly brilliant, able to take all Talmudic literature and conceptualize it. In Rav Soloveitchik's class, we did Masechet Chulin with him, he once made the statement that before Rav Chaim, all of Yorei Di'ah was pots and pans. You get Semicha on Yorei Di'ah about Masar V'Halav, Taruvot, all about pots and pans. Kosher, not kosher. You mix this, you mix that, you milk spoon, you meat spoon. So that's what you get Rav Semicha on. That's what you get Semicha on, right? Before Rav Chaim was all pots and pans. He had 1,000 laws about pots and pans, right? After Rav Chaim, there was 3 principles. He was able to conceptualize Yorei Di'ah, the way of Semicha, in 3 or 4 principles. Conceptualization, which is concepts, you know the whole entire story. They all flow. All details flow from these 2 or 3 different concepts. Right? That's Rav Chaim. So Rav, sorry?
Was he accepted in the right world? Or was
of course, absolutely, 1,000%. Nobody denies Rav Chaim. 1,000%. Nobody could learn like him. Nobody could learn like Rav Soloveitchik either.
But something new,
100% accepted, without question. Correct. Now, so now what for a
new but not different? It wasn't so different.
I don't know. Is it different? It was radical. It was innovative. It was creative. It was bold. It was original.
But it was taking the same old material.
Absolutely. But seeing it, yeah, reworking it. Correct. It's reworking it. So Rav Chaim was, of course, taken in every world. The Rabbi Soloveitchik is the issue. He's the problem because he has a PhD in philosophy and he had deviated, they would say, from the norm.
That's what it is.
Correct. So Rabbi Soloveitchik for sure was not accepted, but Rav Chaim certainly was. His grandpa. So now this is a super intellectual. Every living moment is spent in learning. Talmud Torah. Right? Incredibly so. And what I recommend very highly is that this is a booklet that the Soloveitchik Institute and Brookline Message put out. It's a good introduction. I ordered about 40, hopefully, for next time or the time that I come. And I would suggest you all buy. It's probably about $8 or $10 or what it is. And the back has a CD, which Rabbi Schachter, speaking about his biography, and along the way you get some insight into who Rav Chaim was. It's a great education. It's an hour and a CD that you should all hear, all listen to. So that will get to, we'll come back, hopefully we'll have them by then. I didn't have them today. But okay, so now, for Rav Chaim, super intellectual, learning is everything. Everything is conceptualization and philosophy. Good. So that's the case. What's the role of the rabbi? So quote, Rav Chaim replied to Rav Berlin, when asked what the function of a rabbi is, Rav Chaim replied, quote, to redress the grievances of those who are abandoned and alone, to protect the dignity of the poor, and to save the oppressed from the hands of the oppressor, unquote. Neither ritual decisions nor political leadership constitute the main task of halachic man. Far from it. The actualization of the ideals of justice and righteousness is the pillar of fire which halakhic man follows when he, as a rabbi and a teacher in Israel, serves his community. So Rav Soloveitchik as well would see chesed, kindness, as the focal point, as the Rambam, as the focal point of Isha Halakha. It's not Talmud Torah Kineged Kulam, strangely and strikingly enough. Those who know Rav Soloveitchik know how committed he was to Talmud Torah, to learning. It's all about learning. Learning was a moral discipline, and you'll see when you fail in that moral discipline by not learning properly, you'll see how we responded in a few minutes. But this statement really qualifies that by saying to right the wrong is more important than even learning. If that's the case, then rabbi should be spending the time, and this I'm very much opposed, for me personally, randu bikur holim. Although I do it. Rather than doing all the levayot and doing all of those issues, I could do 24/7 chesed. I could actually spend 24/7 doing chesed. There's that much I have to do. And some rabbis do that, and they have to be praised for doing that. It's not my cup of tea. Can't do it. To me, for whatever reason it is, I'm much more attracted to the learning part of it, to the study, to the teaching of it. That's me. Rabbi Avner Weiss, who's now rabbi in England at this point, told me when we were in South Africa together, he says, becoming a rabbi is great, wonderful, it forced you to do chesed. He's right. You have to do the levayot, you have to do all this chesed, and he's right, you have to do it, it's good. It's wonderful, one should do it. But it's not my natural inclination.
Didn't you be in LA, Abner Weiss?
Switch. Tingle.
Oh, you switch to one?
Yeah.
That's the guy with the lion story?
Yes, correct. Good, 2 points. That's the lion story.
That's the story.
Yes, that's good. It's good, South Africa, 1975. So, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this paragraph of Isha Halakha, as well shows his commitment as a person of deep compassion as the Rambam. Good, both. Both Rabbi Soloveitchik as well as the Rambam were bold thinkers, willing to accept the danger, or better, the religious danger, in thinking. Thinking is not a value-free enterprise. Thinking could be dangerous. Right? Those who have thought know how dangerous thinking could be, especially when you think about religious issues. When the Rambam engaged Aristotle, was he willing to accept the consequences and the responsibility of engaging Aristotle? The answer is, of course, yes. Torah is based on truth. If Aristotle speaks truth, and it's proven as truth, you must accept Aristotle as a true thinker. So what's the fitting that you should know by now, should be coming out of your ears, statement of the Rambam. Excellent. Very good.
Also, the world was not created.
Incredible. I am very impressed. Who's your uncle? It's genetic. It's all in the gene. Correct. The Rambam says that Hakdamat Shema Perakim Shema Haimin Mishamara. Listen to the truth, no matter whatever source it is. And in that context, I was talking about philosophers, Hakamim, any of those people. So whether it's Jew or Gentile, if it's true, you must accept it. So if Aristotle spoke the truth, you must accept it. Period. End story. Right? Good. And as Alpha says as well, and we're in the book 225, again, something that we made reference to in the past, one should be aware, where the Rambam says, boldly, if in fact Aristotle has proven creation is false and eternity of the world slash universe is true, then we must of necessity accept eternity of the world universe, irrespective of what Bereshit teaches us. Irrespective, doesn't make a difference. What do we do with Bereshit? We simply will reinterpret it. Sha'arei Pirushonin Alu, the gates of interpretation have not yet been closed. We will reinterpret all of those Pesukim that do Bereshit, referring to eternity of the world, because there was no creation if we believe Aristotle, and Aristotle had proven it. And we would also then have to reinterpret all miracles as well, of course, goes along with this. We interpreted all miracles didn't happen as breaks in nature. Couldn't be if the world is eternal, as we reinterpret all of the anthropomorphisms of the Bible. So that's a bold statement. You are risking your whole entire Torah in that sense. But that's the Rambam. In every area that he engaged in, he was willing to risk the danger of religious thinking, philosophical thinking, or engaging in theology. The Rambam is obvious. It's clear. What about Rabbi Soloveitchik? Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. Now this is a narrative that I'm going to tell you, a story, that I heard secondhand from somebody that was he who heard it firsthand. Here's the narrative. First story that I'm going to tell you stuff. I'm telling you five stories tonight. This is the first of the stories. Rabbi Soloveitchik had a Semicha student in his class. There are those who say that it was Professor Frederick Summers, who was a professor of philosophy at Brandeis. When I was on my way to Brandeis, they told me that he was the person about whom the story is told. This person is getting Semicha from Rabbi Soloveitchik at one point or other, and he went to Rabbi Soloveitchik privately to say, Rebbe, I have a desire to learn religion at Columbia University. Religion, take a major in religion. Right? Religion does not mean Judaism, religion means comparative religion. It means you study about Islam, Christianity, East, Buddhism, the whole nine yards of it. Right? But I'm afraid to do so. So Rabbi Soloveitchik tells him, if you want to do so, you feel that's where you're going to find truth, then you must do so. But he tells Rabbi Soloveitchik, but it's dangerous. It's dangerous to go study religion in a secular university at Columbia. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, for the past 20 or 30 years, I have flown two or three times a week from Boston to New York to give my shiurim. And it was dangerous. I flew for the last 20 or 30 years, back and forth, and it was yet dangerous to do so. But I did it. Because one has to engage with that which is dangerous sometimes. So the person did so, he went ahead, and he lost all religion. He came back to Rabbi Soloveitchik two or three years later, and said, Rebbe, the plane crashed. Which is very sad. I mean, it's a sad statement. You know, and we don't know what Rabbi Soloveitchik said in response to that. Rabbi Lanner, who was a good friend of mine, had said he was there when that statement. Now, when I was at Brandeis, Professor Summers was at Brandeis, and although we were in different departments, I should have really gone and see if that's a true story. And then, too late, missed opportunity. But I should have gone and found out if that's true or not true. It's certainly an interesting story that tells us about what Rabbi Soloveitchik would have said in that situation. He was not afraid to engage. He might tell this person, make sure your groundings are deep in Judaism to be able to deal with these issues. It's not so simple to deal with it. And maybe he thought that this particular person, if it were Summers or not, was well steeped in Jewish sources before engaging in the study of religion. They thought that he was and was not. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not afraid to engage in any of these disciplines. Good. So now, back to our topic. Our goal is to give a sense or a feeling of who Rabbi Soloveitchik is. Now, in saying that he was in fact this proto-Maimonidean type, and showing the comparisons, I hope that I've shown you already that he does come along once in 1,000 years. Can you think of anybody else in the last 1,000 years of Jewish intellectual history who was so philosophically oriented? Yes, there are multiples of great rabbinic figures who are halakhically concerned, deeply so, the Gaon of Vilna, and many others. Sorry? Not committed to halakha. Sort of.
He didn't have much choice.
That's correct.
He wasn't given choice.
He chose to not be committed to it.
Did he really?
Obviously. First, what came first? He had the chicken, clearly came before the egg. Yeah, he was excommunicated because he was not committed. Yeah.
First?
The interesting point, hold on. That scares me, that statement. That's a close the tapes type of story. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah, the Gaon of Vilna was probably the second. Rabbi Soloveitchik did identify very close with the Gaon of Vilna. But Hirsch was not intellectually open, I would say. Hirsch had his agenda. If you read the 19 letters, I made this point before on other occasions, if you read the 19 letters, I find it to be an extraordinarily unimpressive work. Where he has the truth, you don't get it, you're a fool, pass, is what the 19 letters is really all about. His philology was all wrong, in terms of where he based his whole study on the philological understanding of Tanakh, Torah, is all wrong. Because he thought that the Bible is based on Hebrew with a dual literal root, it's a triliteral root. They philologists saying nowadays. So he wasn't really willing to engage. Plus, he castigated the Rambam for being so affected, influenced by Aristotle, when he himself was affected by Hegelian philosophy and doesn't admit it or not even aware of it. So he wasn't self-reflective. Now, on the other hand, he was willing to do battle with the reformers and with conservative Judaism, and he was a great person in his own right. He was a great person in his own right. But certainly he's not my model of the ideal Jew, because he wasn't searching for truth with the same rigor, intellectual honesty, I believe, as the Rambam, as Rabbi Soloveitchik. So I wouldn't put them in the same category whatsoever. The depth of interpretation of Rabbi Soloveitchik, let's say of an only man of faith, where he talks about Bereshit, Aleph, and Beth, is so profoundly human, you don't get that same sense at all of reading Hirsch. You get information. But there's no analysis, no depth of thought. He's not a deep human thinker. Soloveitchik is very much a deep human thinker. Hirsch didn't have the same mastery of sources. Engaged philosophically, that's true, but not the same mastery of halakhic sources as Rabbi Soloveitchik. You don't see that at all. So it's hard to find somebody who really could match Rabbi Soloveitchik in these areas of incredible mastery of halakha, of the Mesorah, deep abiding commitment traditionally to Jewish sources, without question, a mastery of philosophy, a willingness to engage the modern world and all modern philosophical issues, as we'll see in a couple of weeks. Who else is there? So from the Rambam till now, it's hard to find somebody. Maybe there's somebody, but it's hard to find.
The Soloveitchik, from what I understand, didn't publish much. I mean, obviously I'm pretty ignorant, but he published a lot of works of this matter that you're talking about.
Depends what much is all about. What do you mean by much?
In other words, you're comparing the Rambam, who kind of like, not only did he do his philosophical work, he also put a halakhic work, and you're comparing somebody like that, I mean, to the Rav, who, from what I heard, he really didn't publish that much, except for a few works. And
okay, so what?
His point was maybe very strong in those few works that he published, but it's a very difference between the Rambam, who not only attacked the halakha, but also the philosophy side, like as a whole, as opposed to what you're talking about here, where you don't have
published works.
Yeah.
Okay, what's interesting about that is that because the medium has changed in the last 1,000 years, one can say 2 points. One is that the Rambam spoke to a crowd, let's say 50, 60, 100 people, right? So Soloveitchik, because of the medium of tapes and because of
numbers of students, spoke to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of students. I don't think it'd be exaggeration to say that the Rav directly spoke to hundreds of thousands of people over the course of 40 years of giving shiurim. And to figure it out, he had 100 people to shiur each time. He spoke to 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 people every Yortzeit shiur that he gave for his father and for his mother, right? And for his wife. So there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of people that heard him. Between the tapes, between this, so he didn't have to publish to impact. The Rambam couldn't get beyond the immediate Beit Midrash. Right? So that's number one.
What tapes? We have
hundreds of tapes, hundreds, thousands, yeah.
I have them in my house.
You have some.
I didn't give them back.
You didn't give them back yet. You made any copies, right? Yes. So that's what I like, right?
I found them.
You found
it. The students,
yeah, there's a fellow Abel Vavitz who's a good friend of my in-laws. He's Rav Moshe Feinstein's nephew. Rav Moshe Feinstein's nephew. He was the official taper. He's a businessman, official taper at Maimonides School. Has the tapes of thousands of classes. I mean, hundreds of thousands of classes. Whenever Rav Moshe, he was the official person that gave the tapes. So I once begged him in 1972, 81, 82, for one. Just give me one. He gave me one. Just one he'd give me, but he has closets full of tapes. He doesn't know that the Rav Soloveitchik would want to disseminate them. Therefore, he feels an obligation not to do so, because these are oral presentations. Doesn't mean that everything that you say should necessarily be an official tape. That's one issue, and that's a problem. You sacrifice when you present them, because every lecturer, every speaker knows that the spoken word is not the written word. You may want to make sure that your written word is of an absolute nature. Every single word precisely formulated. And so let's what of that nature? Every word, every line, every phrase had to be precise, exact, accurate. He was that demanding of himself. He strove for excellence in all of his works. His works, these two, The Lowly Man of Faith, which are substantial, Aisha Halacha, as well as Halachic Mind, as well as his five essays in tradition, all of which are wonderful to read, are classic works. The kind of work where when you read it, the first time you say, wow. What happens the second time you read it?
Wow.
Wow. With a little two next to it. Wow.
Square.
You read it a third, fourth, and fifth time. And what happens? Each time. And I've done it. Read along with this at least 5, 6, 7 times. Each time, you can tell because I write them in different colors. My notes are in different colors. Blue, black, pencil, red, green. Oh yeah, here's your red, here's your blue. Why? Because each time you read it, you find something new in it. Which is one of the definitions of the word classic. What makes a work a classic? The nuances. You read it and you hear it again. You see something here. Example given. Let's say you're a fan of the 60s music. Right, some of us are. Now, what happens when you hear it the 15th time? It's boring. Why? Because it's the same. Help me, Rhonda, does not change. It just is the same. Help me, right? That's what it is. However, when you listen to Beethoven the fifth time.
Brian Wilson's music was great. You hear a lot of Brian,
who?
Brian Wilson.
Beach Boys?
The Beatles.
I don't like Beach Boys that much.
He must have got hit in the head with a
surfboard. Little sand on the brain, that's all. He likes the Beach Boys. But and after 20 times, it's born the same. It's all the same. But when you hear Beethoven, it's every time you hear something new. You can't capture it in a phrase. It's just endlessly creative. 200 years later, 300 years later, Beethoven is still challenging to musicologists, what do you really say and how do you really say it? Right? The way that Rabbi Twersky formulates this statement, he'll say, and his work is as well, endlessly repercussive. That's his phrase. That's a classic work. Whenever you read it, it endlessly has repercussions to it. Again and again and again you read it, again and again you feel, wow, look what I have over here. Something extraordinary. So that's these works. I could go back and read this another 5 times. I want to. I have an intellectual desire to read this again. And to read this again. This is only read 2 or 3 times. And again, you read it, say, wow. You have this feeling of incredible, oh, thank you, over there. Incredible joy. Intellectual joy, but that's an important phrase. Intellectual joy in reading this again and again and again. So now, A,
he did write, I would say substantially, I think it's almost mythic, it's a myth, he didn't write a lot. He has five lessons in tradition. He has Isha Halakha, has confrontation. He has the halakhic mind. He has one method. So he has essays, number one. He has a large number of Hebrew essays, a large number that he wrote. Hebrew essays, Yiddish as well. So he did write a lot, much more than everybody here combined had written. So he wrote a lot. Maybe not compared to others tremendously, but he wrote an awful lot, I think. I mean, a lot. If you look at the great scholars, so what have they written? 20, 30 articles and one or two books. Rabbi Twersky and Rabbi Saul Lieberman, they're great scholars. What have they written? So he's written, not hugely, but certainly he's written a lot in Hebrew, English, and in Yiddish. His bibliography must have 100, 200 items. And there are published bibliographies. Tunamadad Journal, I think 5 or 6, 7, has a whole bibliography, I think, of his. So it's a lot. But also, his impact was in the oral presentation. He's given simcha to more people than any other person in history. He's given rabbinic ordination.
Is that
a good thing? Yes. Its impact.
Why?
And that's the highest shiur or level, probably in the world.
Why was he able to do that?
Because everybody flocked to him. In other words, he always had 70 or 80 students, 100 students in his class. I mean, I'm going to describe that in a few minutes. So there were so many people there. So it was probably the highest shiur in the world, people will say to you. And if it's such that he is the greatest teacher, so then he's given all these people. So and again, ask Rabbi Harari, who was there for 1 year, ask him if he was so impacted. He may not have been. I was, as we'll describe later on. So I think he has written, he has impacted, and now, God bless you, it's 10 years later, and still his word reverberates. 10 years later, his word still reverberates. What will be 10 years from now, I don't know. But as Arnold J. Wolfe said, who is Arnold J. Wolfe?
He was,
you don't know that.
Coyote's cousin.
Wrong. Off base. Zoom. He is the Reform Hill Director at Yale University. Now he's the rabbi of a synagogue in Chicago. He said in an article commentary about 10 or 15 years ago, quote, I suspect that 1,000 years from now, they're still going to be reading Soloveitchik, unquote. 1,000 years from now. Why? Because his works are classics. Because when you read it, you want to read it again. And they touch a deeply human spiritual chord in whoever reads it. I guess you have to have a certain background. If you're a high school student, you're not going to be able to read. Then you read this book. This is good for beginners in Rabbi Soloveitchik. But you read The Lonely Man of Faith, which is more challenging. When you read these books, you're touched. So he did really write a lot, and he did impact a lot, and he did affect a lot. So I think he is there. Not as much as the Rambam, that's true. But he did communicate with many more people than the Rambam did. His impact is certainly significant. But, okay. Now, so I made the absurd statement that he's an ideal Jew, which I have not yet defended. I did make the statement that he was very enriching, and what I hope to go through over here is that you will see why he's so enriching as a thinker. Okay? So our goal over here is to give a sense or a feeling of who the Rav is. He is a phenomenon. Many thousands, tens of thousands were deeply impacted by him. He attracted thousands to his shiurim. Again, Yeret HaShir in 1971, I was there. There were thousands of people. 2,000-3,000 people were there. His brilliance is legendary. And this can be discerned from reading his works or having heard his shiurim. Simply, he saw what others did not see. You read a text, and he reads a text. He comes up with a whole formulation that you never had seen, and yet his exposition is so clear, it's so straight, that it's actually simple. That you walk away saying, I knew that all along. He sheds light. So he's able to, open the light. Oh, I knew that all along. I once went to a shiur of his, must have been 1973, going back. And it was on the topic, the synagogue as an institution and as an idea. That was the topic in Rabbi Lipstein Shul, right? And we walked out, it was 2.5 hours, 3 hours, thought it was a brilliant idea, conceptualized what synagogue is really all about. Not historically, but philosophically, what's synagogue really all about? But, and it was a high school student there, 10th grade, says, I was simple, I knew it all along. And I smiled to myself, as you just said, saying that, yeah, it was so simple, so clear. We all thought we knew that all along. But brilliance is the ability to make that which is seemingly obscure, simple, accessible to all. And he did that. He was able to analyze and clarify to the extent that the most obscure text seemed simple. Say, oh yeah, of course. And again, the test is, if you read The Lonely Man of Faith, the first chapter over here talks about Bereshit Aleph and Bet. And at the end of reading it, you'll say to yourself, it's pashut, simple, it's right there, we all know this, it's clear. And yet, what is most striking about that is that nobody in 3,000 years of Jewish commentary on Bereshit ever said anything even remotely similar to what the Rav said in Lonely Man of Faith. And yet you're going to read and say, oh, I knew this all along, it's clear, simple, straightforward, it's a pshat. Now, if it's the pshat, which is an interesting issue, and the fact is the pshat, which means the simple, unordained, unadorned level of the text, if it is the pshat, isn't it interesting that in 3,000 years of Jewish context, nobody ever said it? We means we missed it for 3,000 years. And he came along and said, this is the pshat. You say, yeah, it is the pshat. This is what Torah really means to teach us in Bereshit Aleph and Bet. Nobody ever thought of it before, if it's the pshat. His presentation is so lucid and so clear, and therefore he wrote so little because he wanted it to be so clear, that that very thin line between pshat and darash, is he reading into it or is it really there? Darash is when you read into it. Pshat is what's really there. It's so thin that you're not really sure. This seems to be the pshat of the text. But if it's pshat, I can never have said it before. So maybe it's darash. But it seems to be so tied to the text. He reads text so well, so clear, so simply, that you say, this is the pshat, yet nobody ever said it before. Now, story. In 1974, I was teaching at Magen David Day Camp. Some of you may have been there. I had the assignment of teaching my fifth grade class about tefillin. So one of the points that I want to make is that there are two types of tefillin. Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam. We all know that. So that's the humble for the time, for some insight and some sources. They gave some sources and some insight. Okay, what's it all about? In about 3 or 4 minutes, after all my preparation, I spoke about tefillin, Rashid Rabbeinu Tam. What's the main difference? Well, according to one opinion, the parashur, they both have four parashur, the shodosh, right? And according to one opinion, right, they're either kisera Torah, that you put them in the order of the Torah itself. According to the other opinion, that the two Bahaya should be in the middle. Right? Okay, so I said that, and that was the end of 5 minutes, 8 minutes, that was the whole entire story. But happens to be that 3 months later, now it's October, November, I was at YU that fall, but Salvech gave a shiur, strangely, on Tefillin of Rashid Rabbeinu Tam. He had the same sources that I did. But he spent 3 hours on the differences between these two formulations. Now, you tell me now, what did he explain? What did he say? What does all this have to do with anything? What is Rashid Rabbeinu Tam all about? Well, he was able to construct two different philosophies of religion based on the order of the parashiyot. He saw the order of parashiyot as reflective of two different philosophies of religion. What comes first, the experience of religion or the intellectual perception of religion? Is religion intellectual or is it experiential? That she had one philosophy of religion, and Rabbeinu Tam had another philosophy of religion, and this he gleaned from the order of the parashiyot.
Isn't that isogenical? He's reading into.
Why do you say that?
Into Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam.
So the question is, right now ask the other question. Why did Rashi put the parashiyot in this way? And why did Rabbeinu Tam put it another way? They knew each other. It was his grandfather. Right?
But he's been learning Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam for many, many years. He knows their philosophies.
Wait, you're asking a different question than his? Yeah, we have David's question. Right? So, you have to now read the shiur, go to the shiur, it's published, and I think it's published in Hebrew, actually. And if it's, and you can read the shiur and figure it out. Is he reading into it or is it really there? He's saying that when I look, he's sort of like, I don't know if this is the right word, an archaeologist in reverse, in that he has the finished product, which is that she's order of the parasha, that Bittah's order of the parasha, right? So they have to go back and figure out what were they thinking when they decided to put one way or the other way. What was in their back of their mind? What were they thinking? So he, and you walk away saying, he's right. You walk away reading it or hearing it, saying, yeah, that's obvious. That she was thinking that my philosophy of religion dictates that I should put the parashot in this order, read this order, and his grandson, Abin Otam, his grandson, right? Grandson, I think. Grandson. And he said that Abin Otam said, no, grandpa, it's not that way. You put him this other way, based on his philosophy of religion. Now, obviously, by the way, I am oversimplifying this 3.5 hours. So please be aware of that. So the next step is, if you choose to do this during the summer, David, come, we'll go meet, and we will do this. We will see, and you could decide at that point whether or not it is eisegesis or exegesis. Is it into it, or is it really the pshat? Right?
Well, what are you saying? Is that she and Abin Otam understood these differences?
They understood.
I have a philosophical difference.
Yes, that's what he's saying. That Abin Otam's philosophy of religion dictated that he should put the tefillin in differently than Rashi.
Consciously.
Yeah, it would seem to be. Yeah.
No.
Now that may or may not be historically true. That's what Rashi seems to be saying. Yes, absolutely. Now that may not be historically true, but it's a great exercise in asking the question. Whoever puts on these two tippers of tefillin, say what's the difference and why. So they'll tell you the difference is A, B, C. We all know the difference. So the question is now, why? Chamajah, in talking about these two basic things, does not tell you why they're different. So sometimes, it's interesting that Rabbi Sebastian formulates the question. He formulated the question. Why did they differ in how to put the order of Parashiyot? And then, if we ask Chamajah the question, or Chamajah whatever, they say, well, why is it different? And Stevie says they have different philosophies of religion. Right? So that's an interesting issue. Now you may agree or disagree with Rabbi Sebastian on that, but it's something that one has to discuss about. Yeah.
From these brief comments that you made, there's an assumption that Rabbi Otam did not explain why he switched it around.
Correct. Did not do it. Well, however, it came out. That's what we found in his tefillin. In other words, I don't know. Actually, I don't even know. Right. I don't even know. It's the Gemara Menachot, I think, talks about it. But I don't know if Rabbi Otam ever formulated. I believe he didn't, actually. I never heard it said. If he formulated this halacha, right. He formulated it literally. I mean, we don't have Rabbi Otam's books. No books. He's only quoted into Sefer.
And why did
he? Well, we have to go on.
For a different time.
Okay, good. So that's just one issue. So here we have Rabbi Sebastian spending 3 hours on what took me 8 minutes to do. So again, what is most striking is that no one in the history of Jewish thought ever expressed this idea. That's original, that's bold. So that's bold. One of the hallmarks of Rabbi Soloveitchik is originality and creativity. He'll tell you that Isha Halacha has to be original and creative. A chidush. For me to simply tell you what he said, Mike, you just said, is nonsensical from Rabbi Soloveitchik's point of view. It's not what you have to do. Eitamin HaKham is he who is original and creative, and thereby linking himself to the chain of Mesorah. Simply say what other people said is not the mark of somebody who learns properly, but it's rather creating a new link, a new idea, a new thought.
Now, Perkevah, doesn't it mention like the different types, like there's 3 different categories of rabbis,
and
they're all
good.
5 of the great. I mean, I just kind of wanted to, they hold everything.
Great, excellent point. Yeah, that's what I had mentioned this past, was last Shabbat. We spoke about the second chapter of Perkevah. Rehanam is like I had 5 students, each expresses another characteristic, and I've always struggled with this, it's a great point. Whether or not Ma'ayana Mitgaber, which is the creative and unending flow of Jewish thinking, is the primary category, Rabbi Yehuda ben Arach, or is Bor Su Shinom and Yibet Yipa, which Rabbi Yehuda ben Hulkanus, is that the primary category? And they differ.
Can you translate that?
The Bezalel Hagul says, "Abor sur a cistern. Abor is a cistern, which is overlaid with sur is the plaster that never loses a drop of his learning." Same argument in Masechet Horayot, which talks about what is better, Oker Harim or Sinai, to be a grinder of text, meaning analytical and brilliant, or is it better to be Sinai? In our day and age, obviously Chavad Yosef is a Bor sur Jibet Yipa, great memory. He is a Sinai person. So that's one would say is Mayana Mitgaber. One would say, although he certainly knows everything as well, but he also is a Oker Harim. analytical, conceptual kind of a person.
This is a Sinai person.
Sinai means you have all the knowledge was given at Sinai by heart. That's Chamuvad Yosef. As opposed to he who grinds mountains, which is analytical.
Well,
bold, creative.
You really need to be the Sinai person. Otherwise, forgive me, but a person can become a fool.
You're correct. Good point. But it's not that simple. In that, when Rosalich was learning and studying, none of the Rishonim that we have today were ever published. So they would analyze the Talmud text, and it turns out that he said 30 years later, of course, they published the Ramban, or the Ritva, or Rashba, whatever it was. And many of their formulations were the formulations of the Ramban. What they thought he might have said, or would have said. He didn't have all those four. He didn't have any of the Harim either. He only had the Rishonim, but some, the Rambam, and maybe the Ramban. I don't think he had the Ramban. So he would be Oker Harim, and he would create, but he wouldn't know all that. He wouldn't spend a hundred years, endless hours memorizing Teshuvot. So he doesn't do that. You know, he just doesn't do that. He analyzes it. Here's the truth. Here's the answer. And story. I don't care what anybody else says. He doesn't read other books. He doesn't have a 10,000 book library. And so I do. Why not? He doesn't need it. I need it. He doesn't need it. Because he has the text. He opens it. He analyzes it. And he grinds it. And he conceptualizes it. I want to know what 500 other people said before I come to many conclusions. So that's limiting on my part. Right? Right? So that's what it is. But those are the two prototypes. So right, yes, those two prototypes. Good. So Rabbi Soloveitchik certainly would be that creative, original thinker. And again, a good proof would be to look through this when we bring them, if you want to buy them, or Lonely Man of Faith, which again somebody should read, and you'll see the Rav's interpretation to Beshit Aleph and Bet, which is simple, elegant, yet profound, and, as mentioned, thoroughly original. Good. Two more minutes. And yet, this simple, unadorned pshat, which nobody has said in the last 2,000 years, we think is the pshat. What the text really means. Now, before all else, I'm going to begin with a disclaimer. Disclaimer on my part. All great men have multiples of students. Some are legitimate and genuine students, some are not. Nietzsche once said, "Protect me most of all, defend me most of all, from my students." Now those who know who Nietzsche is know how true that was. Of course you all know the Nazis had adopted him and quoted him because of a sister who misquoted him, and he was right. Nobody wants to have these students who are going to misquote. And students do, because they end up recreating who the master was in their own formulation, their own framework. Great men attract audiences and circles of students. And yet many of these students, either consciously or not, have their own agenda. Larry Kaplan, who's a good friend of mine, a professor of Jewish studies at McGill, wrote a great article saying about, 10 years ago, what's going to happen now is going to be historical revisionism, which means they're going to rewrite who Rabbi Soloveitchik was. And that's what happened. It's accurate that the right-wing community says he didn't care about philosophy, doesn't know interest in philosophy, didn't mean anything to him whatsoever. He did it as a playtime, as a pastime, when he wasn't really interested in living and doing anything serious. That's what they will say about him. And that's not true. It's foolish. It's silly. Because those who lived with him, those who knew how passionate he was about philosophy, as he was about Talmudic learning as well. It wasn't a pastime. He engaged in it seriously as a great mind would. It was not simply a pastime. He spent 7-8 years getting a PhD in philosophy, secular philosophy, not Jewish studies, secular philosophy. Why? Because it was truth and he felt a need to know and connect with truth. So one has to always beware of those students who have their own agenda. I believe Rabbi Meiselman has his own agenda, though he's a nephew-in-law of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I wouldn't read any of his books on it. I think he's really way off base. Rabbi Meir Tursky, who's a grandson, I think is closer to the Rav, but I think he also sees, and I have a lot of respect for him, sees only one dimension. Only one dimension. Because you tend to see in that person the dimension that reflects you, as I am doing as well, obviously. You tend to see in a multifaceted personality those dimensions that reflect who you are. It's, I guess, human nature. But I think that's very true of Rabbi Twersky as well, Meir Twersky. Tremendous Talmid Chacham, but that's the personality. But I think he's off. And on the other hand, when you hear Rabbi Riskin, who studied with him for 7-8 years, and Rabbi Berman, Rabbi Lichtenstein, they see another dimension. And therefore, the truth is that all of these are true. With the exception of Rabbi Meiselman, I think all these dimensions are true. But Soloveitchik did have many facets to him. And he sometimes, you sometimes walked away with a sense of hearing what you wanted to hear. Some people did. Not all, but some people did. Compounded by another story. This is the last story I'll tell you. I'm really out of focus on it, but I know it's 10 pages, so we can't finish it now. The other story is, once I was invited, when I was in the Shi'ur, to his apartment. 4, 5, 6 of us were invited to his apartment at night to spend, you know, an hour, whatever it was. I guess we had tea, I don't know, maybe we didn't have tea, and discussing whatever questions we had. So we went to his apartment, it was a wonderful experience, 5, 6 of us, and one of the persons who were there was saying, said to him, Rebbe, I have a very serious question to ask you. This kind of questions he wants, we asked, he asked him. I don't want to be in college, I shouldn't be in college. I'm afraid of what college is really all about, it's taking away from my learning. He said, why are you? I should be learning, I shouldn't be in college. So now, Rebbe, what should I do? Now what do you think Rabbi Soloveitchik said?
Do what you want to do.
Right? No. Phil, of course, is right. You're all wrong. Where he said, quote, I can't answer that question. I'm not a Hasidic Rebbe. I don't give brachas. It's do what you think is right. Quote, I was there. I don't believe in spiritual slavery. Now, what does that mean? He was an existentialist in the sense that you have to self-determine. He's not going to tell you what to do in life. He's going to throw the ball back in your court. You must spiritually create who you are. So if it's right for you to leave, then leave. If it's right for you to stay, then stay. But I'm not the Rebbe. Now, a Hasidic Rebbe tells you what kind of insurance to buy.
Right.
Everything, from A to Z. You go to the Rebbe for everything, and you go for his brachas. So he does not give out berachot, does not hold you to any kind of spiritual slavery. He says, you do what you want, and what's the end? Bear the consequences. Take responsibility, which is an existential thought as well. So in that context as well, Rabbi Soloveitchik would, in a certain sense, disown many of these students of his. And therefore, if you were Rabbi Riskin, and you want to give, let's say, a Sefer Torah to women to carry Simchat Torah, and of course you would never do anything against Halakha, right? That's an absolute principle. Rabbi Riskin, of course, is a 1,000% bona fide halachic Jew. So you'd go to your Rebbe, to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Don't be misled by my use of the term Rebbe in the Hasidic sense, where he's a Rebbe, and what people used to call him a Rebbe. That's two different senses of the word. Is that clear? Got it? Yes? Okay. So Rabbi Riskin would go to him and say, well, what should I do now? So what would Rabbi Soloveitchik say to him? He'd say, go study the sources on your own and come back to me. So you went to study the sources on your own, and you studied all the Gemarot and everything else. He says, now we talk about it. They discuss the issue. Then he'd say to him, Riskin, what do you think? And he would say what he thought. And Rabbi Soloveitchik would say, your thinking is in line with what you learned. Now, is that an endorsement or not?
You're on the right track. You're on the right track, but again, make your own decision.
Okay, good. So in the same way that you could argue about this is what people now argue about. Some will say, Rabbi Riskin will say, Rabbi Berman will say, Rabbi Riskin will say, that's an endorsement. He said, I could do it. On the other hand, those will say, no, you took out what you wanted from it. And the answer is, Rabbi Soloveitchik is...
It's not in line, because you're ignoring certain things, or you're...
It is in line, so it was in line.
If it was not in line, if you were not endorsing it...
No.
He would tell him as a teacher, as a responsible teacher, he would say...
He learned the whole sugya. So he said, you're not misreading the sources. Your conclusions are valid. But what he's not saying is, maybe there are other conclusions also.
People could have come to two different conclusions.
Exactly. So that's very possible. So Rabbi Meiselman will say, he never said that, about women as a Torah, because he said it to be told to me first. I was there. You weren't there. Yeah, Rabbi Meiselman said, but I was with him. Other times he said, you can't do this. So Rabbi Meiselman probably asked the question in a particular fashion. Isn't it terrible that if women carry the Torah as a Torah? And Rabbi will say, I understand your position.
So how do you learn from a rabbi like this? I mean this with respect.
What do you mean? We have to do this with him all the time.
No, how do you learn?
Wow, what a low blow.
If I came to you when
check
I
said... Check his ID. Just the
long hand. I leave with more questions, then we come in.
Well, that's good. That's really good.
No, if I came to you,
but your point's well taken.
Okay, you know what I mean.
But I think your point's well taken. And the answer is, you learn to be creative and stand on your own two feet. Period.
But you need guidance.
You learn, you get the guidance. One of the stories that I didn't get to, and I'm going to leave now because it is raining and it is late. But I didn't get to half what I want to tell you about. But one of the stories that I'm going to tell you is the, before coming to Deal, New Jersey, I was had a lot of questions and I asked to meet with him. And I met with him for 40 minutes the last week or two that I was in Boston before coming to Deal. And it was just an extraordinary conversation where he taught me how to think on your own two feet. He was willing to take that risk. Not every Rebbe is, not every teacher is. But he says, you've been trained, now do it. So that's one angle. And I take responsibility for what you're doing. So there's a lot more to speak about over here. I hope I gave you some sense, at least, as to who Rabbi Soloveitchik is and was. As well, there again is much, much more to speak about. But I would want you to walk away with a sense of the Rambam and Rabbi Soloveitchik, a sense of how unique Rabbi Soloveitchik was, the values that he emphasized in terms of creativity, originality, boldness, as well, of course, his profound commitment to traditional Judaism. Don't think that he's anything other than that. He studied the sources and followed the sources. But as well, of course, was very much concerned with truth as an absolute. Are there any questions?
Was there any philosophy? Anything you wrote
philosophically
or any
stock
halakha from him at all? Or
mostly oral. All oral, actually. All oral. Although, there are there is two or three books. Two books called Halakhic Positions of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And his students know his positions. He was a very finely tuned halakhist, of course. So he had a lot of psak halakha. A lot. But his students know them. Women covering hair, not covering the hair is a famous one. Eating cheese, not eating cheese, another famous one. So there is a whole two books published by Jason Harrison called The Halakhic Positions of Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's the boy. Two books. And the third is a book on prayer. We had a course in Maimonides, which Rabbi Soloveitchik insisted that we teach, on Birat Tefillah, prayer, which every Shiva should have. How come we don't have it, you know, Magen David? We pray every single day. We all should have this book. And the teacher of it, Rabbi Walgemuth, who's a great personality, wrote up Rabbi Soloveitchik's, partially, I guess, view on prayer. Not only philosophy prayer, but halakhically what to do in prayer. So he wrote up that as well. So those three do have his pronouncements about a lot of those issues. So a lot of it is there. There is a lot of that out. And especially the Mesorah journals, there's 19 of them now published, all have his halakhic positions on a lot of issues. So there's a lot of stuff out.
What about the book Reflections of the Rab? I think by Rabbi Bezdin.
Yeah, it's when it came along in its time, it was great, it was wonderful. It's a journalistic reconstruction of his essays, of his oral presentations, but it's limited also. You don't get the full feeling of it. It's a summary of the Rab's talk. So it's good but not great. Good but not great. Okay.
Next week, Rabbi Harris will speak.
Yes.
The week after
you're... Yes. So I guess the week after I will just finish what I want to do over here, and then if we have the time we'll go into the next step, next stage, Rabbi Soloveitchik as the shaper of American Orthodoxy. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.